Luke chapter 7. We continue our series that we've entitled this thought of that Jesus was filled with compassion. You'll see that language right in the text that we look at tonight. And just looking at various ways of just looking at the fact that Jesus' heart, His love, His favor is directed at people like us. Sometimes we can't always detect His plan, and we can't always detect His movement, but we can always trust His heart. Tonight we're going to talk about Jesus encounters a humbled heart, because He's going to encounter a woman that is at her lowest point, humbled, broken down, really nothing else left here in chapter 7. But before we get there, I want you to imagine something with me. As you know, Jesus spent most of His childhood in a village called Nazareth in Galilee. Nazareth sits on a hillside and sort of up over a ridge. In this day, today, as it did in those days, that was very common. You would put your residential areas where you lived up on the hillsides and leave the smooth plain for agriculture, because that's how you would feed yourself. But being on that hillside, you had a great vantage point to look out over what we know today as the plain of Jezreel, a great vast valley that in their day and today is still a vast area of agriculture. It's called the breadbasket of Israel even to this day. And I can imagine that somewhere in Jesus' lifetime, I certainly, you know, this is imaginative, I can't prove this, but I think it'd be likely. Because up until at least age 12, the children were required to spend some time going to school. And they would do school by going to the synagogue, and the main instruction was done by the rabbis. They would learn to read, they would learn to write. But the bulk of their training was to learn the scriptures, to memorize large sections of scripture, Old Testament scriptures, and to be familiar with the law and the covenants and the history of Israel. Of course, those who were deemed the best and the brightest would continue on in rabbinical training to become rabbis themselves. Those boys that were selected to come follow the rabbi even beyond that what we would say elementary education, but most of the children would go into the trades of their family trades. But I can imagine a rabbi gathering a bunch of squirmy children in his school, in his synagogue school, and says, "Today we're gonna go out and we're gonna sit on the hillside." And the backdrop of this hillside is the vast plain laid out before them. You can show a picture there that might give you a little bit of a sense of it. Of course, Nazareth is over to the left. I'm sorry, that is so contrasty. You can't really see too much from it. You can actually look back there on the back screen if you want. It looks better, but of course you'll get a sore neck, so that won't work too well. But you can imagine, the rabbi could, just by pointing what they could see, he could tell them so much of their history. He could say, "Now if you look to your right, far right, completely to your right, you see this ridge that we're here in Nazareth. If you follow that ridge quite a distance, sort of to the northwest, off toward the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, there's a mountain there that is known as Mount Carmel. And you can just sort of maybe make out it in the distance. And it was on that mountain that one of our great prophets by the name of Elijah went up against Ahab and Jezebel and 400 prophets of Baal. It was 400-1. And they had a contest to see who was God, and the God who answered by fire. And they had a sacrifice that we're familiar with, and they had an altar we're familiar with, but they didn't put fire to it. They asked God to put the fire. And he could tell the story how God rained fire at the request of the prophet of Elijah, and the prophets of Baal were destroyed. He could point the opposite way to his left, sort of to the south and east, and he says, way over the horizon there, it drops into the Jordan River Valley. That's where this valley of Jezreel you see before you goes over. And if you look off in the distance, you'll see a little rise there. That's Mount Gilboa. Mount Gilboa was the place where Saul was defeated. And that's the moment that our great King David became king. That occurred right over there. And lower in this valley, the same valley, is where Gideon took on the Midianites. And you remember how that they started out with thousands of men and he whittled it down to just a small number, and they just took pitchers and lamps, and you know that whole story. It took place right there. If you look in that direction, you're looking where it happened. And that big rise over there, that's Mount Tabor that you're familiar with. If you look sort of at it, probably about your 2 o'clock position, if you look out there, you can see just a rise in the midst of the haze of the day. And that's the city of Megiddo. Back in the time of Solomon, when he was king, that's where he garrisoned his chariots and his mighty armies to protect Israel from invasion. And you see that little hill right there, very close. It's the hill of Moreh. For us in our day, that doesn't ring many bells to us. But you see, on the hillside facing us, you see a little village. That's the village of Nain. I know many of you boys and girls have been there, and your parents have probably taken grain there to sell, or maybe you have family that lives down there. It's only about 6 miles away, so a fairly easy walk to get there. But on the other side of that little hill, the Mount of Moreh, in the old days, there was another city there, a city by the name that we know it of Shunem. And back in the days of Elisha the prophet, there was a couple there, and to us in our Bibles, we would go to 2 Kings chapter 4. He would probably have called out in a particular scroll in the scrolls that are kept in the synagogue. There's a story recorded where there was a man and woman from that city. You can still see the hill right there. And they loved the prophet. And when he would come by, they would house him. And they decided, the scriptures tell us, to build him a room. They basically built a room onto their house. And this was his guest chambers anytime he came. Well, as time went on, he wants to do something for this couple, been so nice to him. And he finds out from his servant that she is childless. So he sends word to her, by this time next year, you're going to have a child by the blessing of God. She thinks that she is being fooled, but less than a year later, God gave her a son that they loved and they cherished. To one day when he was a little older, the son was in the field with his father, and suddenly he collapsed in the field. We'd probably call in our day probably a stroke. The father rushes him to the house, and without hardly saying a word to the husband, she commands one of the servants to get a donkey, and they saddle the donkey, and off they go to find Elisha the prophet. Elisha offers to send Gehazi to go and lay his staff on the son, but she will have none of it. She said, you're going with me or nothing else. So Elisha comes. And when they come to the house, the son is already dead. You can almost hear the boys and girls kind of at this point growing quiet. How's the story going to unfold? And the Bible says that Elisha went in and he'd laid on top of this son and prayed over him. And in something that's mystifying the scriptures, it said suddenly the son sneezed 7 times. I don't know what that was about, but that's what the scriptures tell us. And he sat up, and this one who was dead was restored to life. It happened right there. And let me tell you, boys and girls, our God has promised that someday a greater prophet than Elijah or Elisha is going to come. And the Bible tells us that he's going to heal the sick. He is going to redeem Israel, and he will even bring the dead back to life. Let me take you to that village of Nain in our scriptures. And I wanted to give you that background because there's a certain fulfillment of prophecy and expectation that unless we get that connection to that Old Testament prophet and that raising the dead of that woman of Shunem, we will miss the fact that God had pre-planned that Jesus was going to intersect a funeral in that very same town, to show them and to show us and to show everyone that a greater than the prophets was among them. And his name was Jesus. Did you ever notice Jesus' track record for visiting funerals? He disrupted every one he ever attended. And we're about to read one right now. Verse 11, Luke chapter 7. Now it happened the day after, well, the day after takes you to the previous story, which is the story of the centurion's son being healed in Capernaum. Capernaum's about 20 miles or so from Nain, so they've traveled the day before and then overnight and into the next day. It says, it happened the day after that he went into a city called Nain. Same place we were just talking about. And many of his disciples went with him, and a large crowd. It's not Jesus and then 12 guys following along. It's Jesus and 12 guys and a big crowd following him. It's sort of like a parade. It's a procession. They're going wherever Jesus is going, they're going, and the dust is being kicked up behind them, and they're coming to this village of Nain. So you have this one parade going into Nain, and then you see this. When he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the city was with her. You have one procession crashing into the other procession. You know who's at the head of Jesus' procession? It's him. And as they would bear the body, the dead man is at the head of that procession. And trailing behind are mourners and worshipers, those who were expecting something from Jesus and those who were expecting nothing from Jesus. A preacher of old described it this way: the only begotten Son of the only begotten living Son of God, who was destined to die, was about to meet the only begotten son of this woman who was dead and was about to live. It's an amazing confluence of realities. And it tells us in verse 13, and this is really the key to our whole series about compassion. And it says this: when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came and touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. Then fear came upon all. And they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him went throughout all Judea and the surrounding region. This is one of those moments, in addition to Jesus healing and working miracles, the fact that he shows up in this place that its only claim to fame was this is where Elijah raised the woman of Shunem's son. The greater prophet has come and raised this one back to life. No wonder they say, and it's the reason they do say, a great prophet has risen among us, and God is among us. God has visited his people. I want to just start with this idea for us, because as we're humble, this is what we're going to learn about the compassionate heart of the Lord Jesus. It's the fact that Jesus is there. In our moments that we are troubled, our moments of pressure, our moments of sadness, our moments of despair, where is Jesus? He's right there. He's right there in the middle of it all. And when they come down to the end of this statement and they said, "God has visited his people," that's the phrase I would hope that long after we spend a few moments together on this Lord's Day evening, I hope it will reverberate in your hearts and our minds that God has visited us. God is among us and the Lord is with us. In fact, Jesus promised, "I'm not going to forsake you. I'm with you always, even to the end of the age." You don't have to worry about that one. Well, there's a few things that I want to just progress through this story as we unpackage it. But I want you to see his heart. I want you to see what it's expressed about his heart. When he's there, what he does. Number one, Jesus sees and is moved by compassion. It says in the text, pick it up, verse 13, when the Lord saw her. When the Lord saw her. Well, you might say, well, that would be very hard to miss. Here's this big line of people following Jesus, and here's this big line of people following this body being taken out. And by the way, that was their custom, that the place of burial was always outside the city. So they're coming out through the city gates, and Jesus coming into the city gates, so you have this intersection. Also, they would typically, if at all possible, the burial was accomplished before sundown on the day of death. So this is very fresh, okay? This is just like in the right now. And so we have this taking place. But he sees her. It means more than just, okay, everybody get out of the way. Get out of the way. We've got to let them through. No, he sees her. He sees that she has a need. He sees her. I don't want to make us uncomfortable, but I think we could all agree with this. There's sometimes that we're in situations that we just, if we allow ourselves, we prefer just to look away. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to expose myself to that. That's too sad. That's too heart-wrenching. That's too disturbing. I just don't want to. Jesus just straight on, head on, he sees this woman. He sees her. Notice he didn't see the crowd, and there was a bunch of them. He doesn't see the city in some generic sense. He sees her as an individual with a broken heart, been humbled and stripped of everything that was precious to her. And he sees her. It says in verse 12, giving us a little exposition about her, this one who was being carried out was the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. In their system, if a woman was left a widow, it immediately fell to the eldest son to take full responsibility for that mother, to make sure she was housed and cared for and had all of her needs met. That was how it was done. But if you were a widow and you only had one child and that one child is now deceased, you had no one obligated to look after you. That doesn't mean that everybody was a widow, was left to fend for themselves. There could have been other family members step in. But it was a particularly, I mean, I can't imagine going out to bury one of your children. What a horrible, difficult thing to contemplate. And the sorrow of that is enormous. But then the only one, and then the only member of her family that she has left, it would have had to have been heartbreaking. But Jesus sees her. And then it says this. Not only did he just see, like, oh boy, that's sad. No, he's moved. It says this in the text. He had compassion on her. You see, Jesus is moved with compassion. Because, first of all, Jesus sees what no one else does. He immediately knew the situation. He sized it up. He could relate. He could empathize. He knew what she was feeling. He knew what she was thinking. He knew what the potential was for her future. When Jesus looks out and sees us in our moments of despair, he gets it. He understands it. Oftentimes when we're trying to help somebody, with all the best intentions, the best of heart, we look at people in difficult situations and we don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. We can't look at them and say, well, I know how you feel, because you really don't. But Jesus has none of those limitations. He sees and his heart is moved. Why? Because he can not only see what no one else sees, but he feels what no one else can. Because of his heart. Now, the word translated compassion is an interesting one. If you just kind of peel back the English and look at the language underneath of it, which is Koine Greek, it's actually a fun word to say, splochnizomai. It's a fun word to say. But it's a compound word. Nizobai means to move or to be pushed or to be motivated in a certain way. Splochna means, I could show it to you better than I could tell it to you. It means this right here. Your belly, your insides. Have you ever wondered if you grew up reading the original King James, there's those places where it talks about, it uses the phrase, bowels of mercy. And you say, what in the world is that? Some of you maybe have never read that and you don't know what I'm talking about. But it means that same thing. Your splachna. In Jewish thinking, rather than saying, my heart is moved, you would say, my belly is moved. I want to be careful how I say this, okay? Because the seat of emotion was here, and you can understand how that metaphor could be. You know, we talk about, oh, I'm nervous, I've got butterflies, or my stomach's turning in knots thinking about this thing. You know, we sort of have this reflexive emotional sense in this part of our body, and so that became the seat of emotions. We've now moved it to the heart. I can't imagine of course, they didn't have Valentine's Day in their day, but I don't know what kind of cards they would send when the heart wasn't the seat of emotion. I don't know how that worked or would have worked. But what it's saying in the text was his innermost being, right down to the core of who he was, his insides, if you will. We would say it, his heart, but that's not what the word literally means. Was just taken, captivated by this woman's need. He saw and he had compassion on her. Sometimes life hurts. Sometimes life disappoints. Sometimes life, from our estimation, comes up short. But I assure you, we never have the right to question the compassion of our Lord. Just because we don't understand what He's doing, just because we can't figure it out, just because it goes on longer than we think it should, or it hurts more than we would ever wish it would, Jesus' heart is what He sees. He's moved by a nameless widow in a village of Nain. And the same is true of the people that we represent, the persons that we are, in whatever situation you're in. This Lord that we have, He sees and He is moved by compassion. Why? Because He can do what He sees what no one else sees. He feels what no one else sees. You see, in our moments of despair, Jesus indeed is there. Sometimes in our grief, sometimes in our troubles, after we contemplate this a little bit and we think about it a little bit, sometimes we come to the conclusion after we've kind of processed a while, you know what, well, okay, Jesus is here. I know somehow he's bound up in all of this. Excuse me. What we need to do, if as God helps us and as we mature, from the first moment of any experience, that's when we need to do this process. Jesus is here. He's here. He sees. He knows. He's filled with compassion. He sees what no one else can see. He knows exactly what you're feeling. He can feel what no one else can because he is who He is. So when you see this little phrase tucked in, He saw her and he had compassion on her, understand that Jesus' heart, his core being, is no different for us than it was for her in that day. So let that encourage you. Not only does Jesus see and hear, see and is moved by compassion, He also speaks. Jesus not only sees, but He also speaks. You know, it is one thing for us to look at someone and say, wow, they're going through a tough time. Wow, that must be tough. My heart is broken for them. But we never put words to it. We never attach action to it. It just sort of sits there as a reality on the inside. But Jesus speaks. Look in verse 13 again. When the Lord saw her, He had compassion. He said to her, "Do not weep." Well, that would sort of indicate that she was weeping, correct? If you're going to stop something, it has already started. We would not expect her to be doing anything but weeping. That's the normal. And then Jesus says, "Do not weep." And for us, oftentimes what Jesus does, if you read the Gospels, do you not have to face it? Sometimes He just does something and we just go like, "What is that? Where is He going with that?" Well, you understand, this is God interacting with us, okay? So there should be... You should expect some disconnect between what we expect and what we think and what He does. But Jesus already knows the end of the story. We've already read it, so it's no surprise to you. But this woman doesn't know it. The people coming behind her don't know it. The people walking behind Jesus don't know it. And you just think for a moment, there's a lot of things you and I don't know that Jesus already totally never doubted, never lacked information for a moment. He knows all about it. So He speaks. He says what no one else will. He says what no one else will. There would be no one in that crowd that would have dared tell this woman, "Now stop your crying, stop your weeping." If anything else, they were going to join in her weeping with her. They were going to shed a tear alongside of her and feel something of what she felt. But why does Jesus approach it differently? Because He's Jesus. Because He knows what He can do. And He says what no one else can. Because He has this unique perspective that is unique to Him. Now, there's no response here. He says, "Do not weep." No one says anything. No one argues with Him. No one says, you know, it just evacuates all the chatter and all the speech. That's kind of how I view it. He says to this woman, you know, "Do not weep." And suddenly, everyone's thinking, where are we going with this? I think part of it was there was just, they didn't know what to say. I think that probably, I know the people walking behind Jesus had some level of respect for His person. Probably many people in Nain knew who Jesus was by that point because his popularity was already rising. Probably many of them had heard him preach or teach in their synagogue because Jesus taught in all the synagogues in that area at one time or another. So they're just being polite. Okay, you have the floor. They didn't know what to say. Maybe they were just trying to put on bravery at their own no answer. In our moments of despair, sometimes we don't say the right thing or we don't know what to say. But here's the reality. Just remember this. In your moments of despair and every other kind of moment as well, just remember this. Just file this away. Lock this down tight. May it just be branded to our souls. May it be riveted to the halls of our mind that whenever and whatever, Jesus indeed is there. He's there. And then not only does he speak, he also reaches out. Verse 14. Now we would just tend to read verse 14 and just zip right through, but now think our way through this. Then he came and touched the open coffin. Let me first of all deal with the burial customs, then we'll come back to what he does. What it says, and I'm reading from the New King James, so it says in an open coffin. That's our best attempt to describe what's going on, but the Jews did not bury in coffins, okay? They did not put bodies into a nicely crafted wooden container or what else. They would just simply be wrapped up and buried or laid in a tomb, and later bones would be put into an ossuary or what we would call more graphically a bone box, but they didn't bury in a coffin. So when you see this term, literally it means like a stretcher or a bier. It means just they were carrying along something to carry the body on. So the body is probably already wrapped and prepared, or maybe it is on the way to be wrapped. The fact that he sits up probably would indicate that maybe that even that preparation is going to take place at the burial site. But nonetheless, they didn't have to open a coffin or the lid was off or whatever. He's just laying on this stretcher, okay? So, he not only speaks, but he reaches out. Look what he does, 14. And he came and touched the stretcher of this coffin. And those who carried him stood still. We think, well, what's the big deal? This would have been a shocking moment. Especially if you're a rabbi, and Jesus had taken on that outward appearance of a rabbi. In fact, numerous times in the Gospels, he was called a rabbi because he had that form and structure to his teaching, and he had disciples, which rabbis would have had, and so forth. One thing a rabbi would not do would be touching a dead person or the thing that a dead person is being carried on, because immediately you were unclean when you touched that. You had to separate. You couldn't be involved in worship and all those sorts of things. You weren't going to hold the Torah. You were going to hold the scrolls. You weren't going to teach until you had to go and be purified. So the last thing you're going to do is go and touch something containing a dead body because you were defiled when that takes place. Jesus steps forward and touches it. There's a reason he touches it, and he's the only one who could do this. You and I understand that we try hard to keep ourselves clean, but inevitably we get dirty again and have to go back and wash our hands or bathe. We understand that. Sometimes I've used this illustration with children, thinking about how corruption and sin passes on, you know. Sometimes I say this. Now imagine I'm all dressed in, you know, my Sunday clothes and I'm nice, and you go and roll in a mud hole. And, you know, the kids are... You know, I mean, you got mud dripping all over. I mean, you got gooey, stinky, sticky mud just all over you. And I say, come here and give me a hug. Now, what's going to happen? Are you going to get clean because you hug me, or am I going to get dirty because you hug me? And of course, my mud is going to get on you. There's that defiling thing of how when you're around things that are corrupt, the corruption spreads. It's not the cleanness spreads, except in Jesus' case. Because he is absolutely pure and righteous and holy, and what he touches, even though it's defiled, the absolute opposite takes place. He spreads cleanliness and purity when the only thing we can spread is defilement and corruption because of his sinlessness. And I think he tries to illustrate that. And it says they all stood still. You know, I'm just carrying a body. I'm just trying to get to a burial place. And the rabbi comes and he touches it, and we're all going like, ah! But not only does he speak, he also reaches out. Why? Because he's willing to reach out to the defiled. You see, there is not such a thing as a sinner who is too much of a sinner for Jesus to touch and cleanse and change if they will turn to him in faith. There is no one that is too far gone. There's no one that's too far down. Now, maybe their sin and their patterns of life, from us from a human standpoint, we say, that is really, you know, intertangled and messed up, and they got, you know, that's a lot of stuff to deal with. But remember, when Jesus touches, if someone will open their heart, it changes everything. And don't let ever anyone think, oh, that's too late for me, or I'm too bad, or I'm too far gone. No, this guy was dead. That's about as far gone as you can get. And something very significant is just about to happen. You see, not only is he reach out to the defiled, but he's willing to reach out to the dead. I mean, he's dead. The only place this guy is going, his body is going into a tomb or into a grave. That's what this is all about. We've just got to get him there. We've got to get him buried. Mother's going to have to deal with the tragedy and the heartbreak of it all. And we've come to show our respects, and probably the whole village pretty much turns out to... And relatives have come flocking to be with her and this possession. But this funeral procession is interrupted by Jesus. And he comes and he touches. And then he speaks. And he said, young man, I say to you, arise. Now, this man who's about to be raised from the dead, I have some bad news to give you. This is true of Jairus' daughter. This is true of Lazarus. This was true of the one that Elisha raised that we talked about back in 2 Kings a moment ago. They all died again. They were restored back to this life, but they all had to die again. Some ways you kind of feel a little bit sad for them. I mean, yeah, they were granted life again, which is a good thing, but I would not want to go through death more than once. And I'm hoping if I'm around when Jesus comes back, I can just skip it all together. Well, that would be great if the Lord should will. But when he says to this young man, arise, think about this. He's going to say something far better to you someday. And maybe it's after we are dead and gone and our soul was already with the Lord, but he'll say, arise, and our body will be resurrected and then changed and glorified and made like unto his glorious body. And we will never, ever decay, wear out, get old, have suffering and pain or tears, but we will be permanently restored to what he wants us to be. Something better is coming. Why? What do we need to remember? In our moments of despair, Jesus is there. Sometimes we think of death as being, forgive me for saying this, I understand what I'm trying to say here, but sometimes we make death worse than what it is. Now, I know you say, well, death is pretty bad. Yeah, it is. But for a believer now, let me put that qualification on. For a believer, it's just the passage into our eternal glory. And this is some time ago, standing beside an open casket with a man I've known, and his brother had passed away there for the visitation. And the one that had died had been through a long siege of disease and sickness, just one of those just awful runs of whatever. I remember stepping up there, and the first thing he says to me, he says, my brother's been healed. I thought, what a great thing today. He's not with me. I miss him. He's not here. We're gonna have a big hole in our lives and our hearts and our family, but he's been healed, because that's the permanent. That's the real. Jesus is there. So he reaches out, and notice it just says, young man, I say to you, arise. So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. You know, when I read verse 15, what I think of? Luke, why didn't you write down what he said? Yeah, could you put a footnote down at the bottom of the scroll and said, by the way, here's what he had. He just came back from the dead. He might have had some information for us. Or maybe just be interesting to say what he said to his mother. Did he talk to his mother? Did he talk to Jesus? Did he talk to everybody? Or maybe he sat up and said, what did you do that for? I don't know. It just doesn't say. But the point that Luke is making is not that he said, but that he spoke, indicating that he really was alive again. This brings us to our last point. Jesus not only reaches out, but he changes absolutely everything. And you'll see that in three quick aspects. Then fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen up among us." See, they had in the back of what occurred on this, on the opposite side of this little hillside of Mount Moriah, there in the plain of Jezreel. This was the place where God sent a prophet to raise the dead. And now God has sent another great prophet. That's how they understood him at that point. We know he's more than a prophet, but that's their perception. A great prophet who has raised the dead, has risen among us. You see, first of all, when he reaches out, when we know he's there, he can change the situation of those who are lost and hurt. Okay? He reaches out, he changes everything. He changes the situation for the hurting. In this case, he did a gracious and wonderful and a startling thing. This man was dead. He's now alive, and he gives him to his mother. And how could you even imagine what must have been going on in this woman's heart? To go from we're carrying him out to the funeral to we bump into Jesus, so he sets up and he starts talking, and I embrace my living son, whose cold, lifeless, stiff body was in front of us just moments ago. And here he is. No wonder it says, and fear came upon all. I just think when he set up, there just had to be a hush, just a collective sigh, just through both of those processions, both coming into the city and going out. And they were fearful in what was going on. And they secondly, it changes the focus of the faithful, those who believed in God. A great prophet has risen among us. God has visited his people. It says that they glorify God, saying, these were the things that were stated. I think he says, young man, arise. He sits up and he begins to speak, and he ushers him to his, as the people let the stretcher down, as he rises and embraces his mother. Someone in the back of the crowd, I think, shouts it out. A great prophet has risen up among us. Someone shouting in retort, in refrain, God has visited his people. God showed up here today. He changed the focus of the faithful. And we need our focus changed so often, don't we? We get all caught up in what's wrong and what's bad and what's sad and what isn't glad. And we need to come back to this focus that Jesus is there and he can change everything. And part of that change sometimes isn't changing the situation. Sometimes he changes us to give us the strength to endure it. Or he gives us the patience to wait until he's finished with his ultimate program. Sometimes the hurt does not always go away. But to show us that God can give us whatever he needs, he has these moments that he steps in and he does something very dramatic like he does in this woman's life. And lastly, he changes the opinion of the skeptical. Now, it says verse 17, and this report went throughout all Judea and all the surrounding region. Then the disciples of John reported him concerning all these things. It seems likely that John was having some questions. It basically says that in the text. Verse 19, John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to Jesus, saying, here's the question I want you to take to Jesus. Are you the coming one, or should we look for another? I mean, probably John was thinking like everybody else was thinking, where's the kingdom? Where's getting rid of the Romans? Where's setting everything right? And you remember John was in the process of going to pay the ultimate price for his stand for the truth. You remember he was imprisoned and had his head cut off and presented to the officials on a platter. As horrible as that sounds, which was true. She says, I need to know. I need some reassurance. This isn't going the way I thought. And you think of all the people, John. But John had his moments like we have our moments. And sometimes we wonder, Lord, are you in this? Are you at work? When the men had come to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? And that very hour he cured many infirmities, afflictions, and evil spirits, and many blind he gave sight. And he answered and said to them, quote, go and tell John the things you've seen and heard, that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the gospel to preach, have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me. Even when it doesn't seem like it should be going the way it's going, understand, if we just understand that Jesus is there, he's really there, it's really true, we need to come to this reality that look at what you see. Look at what he can do. And I think John was encouraged. I'm not going to take time to read the next section beginning at verse 24, but Jesus, it's interesting, on the day that John said the worst thing he ever said about Jesus, are you the one? Is the same day that he says about Jesus in verse 28, I say to you, among those born of woman, there is not a greater prophet than John the Baptist. You know, on the day he said the worst thing he said about Jesus, Jesus says the best thing he could ever say about anybody to John in his grace. This story is given just to tell us one simple thing, that in our moments of despair, Jesus is there, no matter what's going on. Are you living, are we living right now in the assurance that Jesus is here and with us? I hope this account from the Scriptures will just continue to pay some ongoing dividends in the account of our heart. Next time something comes and disappoints or a question happens or we just wonder, what is that all about? The first thing you'll remember is this, that Jesus is there.